So the topic of our consideration today is justice and mercy of the karmic law. Now there is a general misconception that the law of karma in its retributive aspect is too stern and exacting, and there is no room for it to temper it with mercy. So, people who criticize the doctrine of karma invoke this particular objection. And believers in exists a personal God say that belief in an outside God, personal God, who when prayed to with all sincerity and repentance will ward off the effect of their misdeeds and grants their wishes, and that they find solace in such a belief. Now, what Theosophy says is that both these views are not in accord with truth and fact. So what is not in accord with truth and fact are necessarily rooted in error. And when we think and act on the basis of ideas and beliefs which have an erroneous basis, invariably leads to problems. It leads to more misery. So, therefore, this appears to be the real cause of the world's woes, world's problems, because we have wrong ideas about life and wrong conceptions, wrong beliefs, and we act on those basis and become bewildered by the effects our actions produced. Now, it is very important for us to consider the true teachings of countless generations of great sages and seers from time immemorial in all parts of the world. They have one doctrine, they have one law, one science. They all have one aim, and they encompass, you know, their aim and their whole object of existence encompasses the whole of humanity and its future destiny. So we must listen to what they are saying. It is there in the Upanishads, it is there in the Paramahansa which we considered in the morning, in the Book of Hermes, and in every ancient religion. So if we go to the source and parent source of all these great religious philosophies, that parent source we call Theosophy, we must consider the basic ideas about it. And it is in with reference to those basic ideas, understand them and see the self-evident truths on which those ideas are based, learn to apply them, learn to use them as a mathematician would use a theorem to solve a problem, and see what brilliant light it throws on all problems of life, whether it's scientific or whether it is social, political, whatever. So you get a clear light where we err, what is the truth. So what is the road to true knowledge and true way of life? So we have to consider them. Now, the basic idea, the Theosophy gives us is there is but one life. We see many. We see the universe and nature to be very diverse. No doubt it is diverse. But underlying this apparent diversity, there is a unity. So there is that one life from which arises multiplicity and diversity of beings from that one source, and every such differentiation being a mirror of the one infinite eternal self. And every such differentiated unit has, under the impulse of the karmic, cyclic and evolutionary law, to return to the source from which they emanated. And the since every being has potentially the infinite potentiality of that one life in each, so the whole process of evolution is the unfoldment of that potentiality. That's why Upanishad say all the beings same in kind, but they differ in degree. They differ in the degree of unfoldment or evolutionary progress. And man occupies the highest point in that evolutionary source towards the great source from which the beings emanated. And the ultimate destiny being, through self-effort and merit alone, checked by his own karma, that every being, after passing through the human stage and through the human stage, checked by the law of karma and reincarnation and metempsychosis, by his own self-effort, and learn from his mistakes by experiencing the effects of his own actions, learn and then understand that he himself is the microcosm of the great macrocosm, that every being is a great microcosm of the great macrocosm, and self-consciously realize his oneness with all. And conscious realization of unity of Atman, that would be divinity. So that hierarchy of beings, from lowest to the highest, man occupying the stage between the subhuman and the suprahuman. So this basic idea should never be lost sight of. Look what Plato says about this one life. It is very important. In fact, Platonic philosophy is the purest exposition of Vedanta, Vedic. But in the form of a dialogue which is highly rational and intuitive. He says, I quote, beyond all finite existences and secondary causes, all laws, ideas and principles, there is an intelligence or mind, nous, the spirit, the first principle of all principles, the supreme idea, on which all other ideas are grounded, the ultimate substance from which all things derive their being and essence, the first and efficient cause of all order, harmony, and beauty, and excellence, and goodness, which pervades the universe, who is called by the way of preeminence and excellence, the supreme good, the God, Theos, the God over all. This is the idea of God, a deity of Theosophy. Therefore, you see here that this one life, in which is inherent the order, beauty, harmony, which is the word justice, which includes mercy, inherent in it, since it is all pervading, since all the beings are a differentiation of it. This justice is inherent in every being. So Plato rightly said that justice is the quality of every soul. It's not that some outside power judges our actions. We perform actions according to our right, wrong or right ideas. We are the witnesses. We are the performers of action. We are the judge of our own actions. We are our own executioners. So justice is inherent in us. This must never be, this is a very important basic idea. And justice inheres in every soul. That's why there is one aphorism of karma. We have 33 aphorisms on karma. In that, the very first aphorism says, there is no karma unless there is a being to make it or feel its effects. Another very important idea that you must keep in mind. So, justice and mercy are the two aspects of one reality. They cannot be separated at all. Usually we say mercy means, when we say be merciful means that the effect of injustice done is wiped away. No, it cannot be. You may exercise mercy, but the effect of the injustice done can never be wiped away. And the retributive justice that meets you by your wrong action can never be deterred, because the law of harmony of the universe is incessantly acting and never can be thwarted, diverted, or avoided. So the adjustment of the harmony that we created can only be adjusted by experiencing the effects of our own action. There is no way by which we can adjust the disturbed harmony, harmony that we disturbed by our wrong action. And again, reap the benefits of the good actions that we may do. Therefore, we cannot realize this perfection of justice and harmony of the order of nature, in which justice and mercy are the two aspects of one and the same reality. We cannot realize this perfection in human laws, in human relations, because of the limitation of human nature and imperfection of human nature. We cannot realize it. Therefore, human laws are necessarily imperfect, necessarily unjust. We may have statute books, we may have criminal law and all laws of the land, but they are imperfect and there is injustice inherent in it. Therefore, the error of human justice. Take for instance, a person who has offended against others or against society. He is apprehended and punished. His offense has caused much harm to society as a whole and to many of his fellow men. But the offender is caught and punished by the human laws and imprisonment or whatever, or he may be even death by hanging or whatever. This is retaliatory justice, inherently imperfect and unkind. Because in the human law of retributive justice, there is no scope for the rectitude and reform and return to the right ways of the offender. There is no scope for it. Though the offender is punished, the effects of the loss and pain suffered by others is not compensated. So you see, it is highly imperfect. And then when you suffer injustice by the act of another and suffer a loss, suffer pain, and then in your spirit of charity you forgive him, you show mercy and forgive him, that's a very good thing. One who exercises the quality of mercy derives great benefit by the law. But then that does not mitigate the effects of the offense done by the offender. It has to run its course. And not only is the offense committed by the offender is not confined to the offender and the victim, but it has its ripple throughout the universe. Just like a stone thrown in a pond sets up ripples, goes to the extremities of the pond and then reconverges to the point where the disturbance occurred and oscillates till the harmony is established. So is every act and thought of every being. So when the reaction comes, how does it act? All that one did by way of help, by way of harmony, acting in conformity with the harmony of life, cause of happiness, you know, worked in for the benefit of others, and all those kindly acts, invariably through readjustment, the individual experiences help, happiness, and prosperity, opportunities, and so on. And every misdeed or wrongdoing and evil or wicked thing that he did, not only it affects all, as I already said, affects all of the kingdoms of nature. And such actions have an effect of thwarting the harmonious, incessant progression of all beings to the one source. And it creates terrible disturbance. And Theosophy shows that every selfish act is inherent in it, there is violence. And it creates the most, the retributive aspect of karma, and the being suffers the pain out of it. When the retributive karma meets us and we feel the pain and suffering of it, by which alone can we ever readjust the harmony that we disturb. It does not come to merely punish and condemn us, but as if with a view to rouse our conscience to ask why this has happened. Search for the cause, search for the truth. And then life after life of such experiences of acting, the way we do, and then reaping the effects of it, the pains and suffering, and ultimately we come to realize and understand with the growth of discriminative knowledge, buddhi, what binds us and what releases from bondage, what makes for harmony, what makes for discord and disharmony, what makes for good and what is evil. So we learn this and learn to work in harmony and in harmony with the life and the progression of the universe. And this alone will lead us to the highest path. So there's a whole process of learning. So when the retributive justice meets us and we suffer the pain of it, it is only through that we learn. So in that is the mercy of the law of karma. Exercise of mercy does not mean the revision of the effects of the offense committed. The mercy, the truest mercy, consists in making the fullest adjustments of the harmony disturbed through corresponding suffering. And in that process is the lessons of life learned, which can be learned in no other way. It is thus that justice and mercy are the two aspects of one and the same thing. And let's consider some of the very important aspects of applications of this very important law. Now, we often suffer from the effects of actions of others, and we find many are inimical to us. You know, we have this antipathies and sympathies. You know, family circle, we don't like some people. Some people don't like us in the official circles, in family circles. Yeah. So we have enemies, and some positively hurt us. Now, the reaction of an ignorant man is to retaliate, or, you know, entertain the feeling of vengeance and animosity. day of ignorance. But once we understand this law, that no hurt can ever come to us, the cause of which we have not sown ourselves, that the hand that smites us is not others but our own, the apparent offender who offends us is only an agent of the working of that law. And if you understand that, we'll have no animosity, we'll never entertain a feeling of vengeance against the one who offends us. But on the contrary, see the causes which led to this. And instead of the feeling of vengeance, you show love. Absolutely no ill will, but abundant goodwill, because each being is a part of that universal harmony and justice. Deity is sitting in the heart of all. So you don't see the incidental personalities, we are mere shadow of the real man, but see with your higher knowledge and wisdom the real man. We are part and parcel of the eternal harmony, universal brotherhood. So forgiveness comes. So no animosity. When you entertain that feeling, and when opportunity arises, do good to the one who does evil to you, then you have given no opportunity for the law of retribution to act further. And you have set up a cause in the opposite direction. And it goes in a long way to mitigate the adverse causes that you have generated, which brought you the pain. And it will have a tremendous impact on the one who does you offense. And a transformation is slowly brought about. And who was your enemy will become gradually, over a time, your benefactor. So converting, transforming the apparent adverse situation into one of opportunity and growth and evolution. This can be done only by a knowledge of law of karma, not by prayer, not by anything else. So, that's why there's a marvelous book of devotion which expresses in a most magnificent manner the laws of higher life and soul evolution, called the Light of the Path. One of the verses in the Light of the Path says, no man is your enemy, no man is your friend, all alike are your teachers. So life is a school, life is one pilgrimage. Let's not get stuck with just this one personal life, beginning with the cradle and ending with the grave. This is just a momentary shadow of the real man who is eternal, having gone through immense past experiences. The cream of all those experiences in us, in our stupendous store of karmic energy. And if you have the right attitude and right approach to life, you can draw upon that energy. Now, there's another very important point. When suffering comes to us, which we have seen, when my own mother suffered from cancer, she said, oh, this should not have happened to me. What did I do to merit it? She suffered from cancer. And so is, we meet such cases everywhere. Earthquake happens and runs through the town, and there is a ruin all around, and there is a flood, and there is something, some other calamity, a personal calamity. And the victim says, why this happened to me? This should not have happened to me. What did I do to merit it? So the assumption is, this suffering is unmerited. It should not have come to me. Now look at how the law works. As we discussed the previous meeting, there is not one moment, a fraction of a moment, that you cease acting, because every thought is an action and it produces an effect. The moment you entertain the feeling that this suffering was unmerited by me, there and then the law takes its course, the law of compensation. This is the merciful aspect of karma. So you set up a cause which has produced an effect, the fructification of which into action when the body dies, when the soul is released from the body. Soul can never die because it is made up of thoughts, formed of thoughts, founded on our thoughts, eternal thinker. The body comes and goes, which he uses and to which he acts, but the eternal thinker is timeless. So, when he dies, all the thoughts of the whole lifetime, the stupendous amount of energy. So, this, it has its effect, we'll come to that later, but this particular strain of thought of unmerited suffering brings into action the law of compensation, by which after the process of segregation of principles, the entity, the ego, falls into a highly spiritual condition of spiritual consciousness, disembodied state, called in theosophical parlance Devakan, or Sukhavati, or Swarga, in various names they are called. The happy hunting ground, the Red Indians used to see of it. Happy hunting ground. So it falls into that spiritual state of consciousness in which it enjoys an unalloyed, uninterrupted bliss and happiness, because there is nothing of the earthly, having discarded the body and the subtler bodies which connect the soul to the body. All that it has is it bathes in the Atma Buddhi with all the cream of its life experiences, plus the effect of this unmerited suffering, which puts it into a state of bliss, in which every tear of pain that it shed is wiped away and hundredfold compensated with bliss. And this is the most merciful aspect of karma. Not only is the effect of unmerited suffering, but all the noble thoughts and noble aspirations. How many of higher aspirations do we realize in our life? We have so many limitations and difficulties. We cannot realize all our higher thoughts and aspirations. But those higher thoughts and aspirations are a very powerful force. Human brain is a dynamic power in nature. People say the calamities of nature occur accidentally. No. It's caused by human power of thought. One of the aphorisms of karma speaks of it. So, when the person dies, there's a segregation. All that pertains to the earthly or passional nature is cast away in the condition beyond the gross, the subtler realm called Kamaloka. Just like he casts off the body, he casts off his grosser thought energies, and the superfine spiritual energies of his finer thoughts can never die, undying. It is harmonious with his divine self, and these become the seed of spiritual conscious life, as if the earth life is continued minus all the suffering, but development of those higher aspirations to the fullest extent within the limits of karmic action. And there it assimilates those experiences, goes to make for the progress of the ego. The soul is rested, refreshed, and enriched, and through assimilation of this progress it makes its higher stage of evolution. So this is the most merciful aspect of the law of karma. And then we say that we didn't merit the suffering that comes to us. That's because of our imperfect nature and wrong basis of thought and action, we have not coordinated our waking consciousness, brain, mind, with the real higher mind where the true knowledge exists. But the ego is not limited to time and space. The ego, the true ego, the real ego, knows all its past. He knows all the justice of the karmic effectory action. The spirit in the body is called Maheshwara, the great lord, the spectator, the admonisher, as Bhagavad Gita says. It knows. Our higher self knows. And if we are not coordinated because of our wrong thinking and wrong direction, we have out of tune with it. Therefore we say, oh, I don't know, you should not have come to me. But there are great ones who have brought about this perfect adjustment of the animal with the human and human with the divine, and brought in perfect conformity. They know. They know every, they can trace every effect, every event to its cause, and they can trace the chain of cause and effect, the moral law of causation, and know how to act, what to do, what not to do, what is karma and what is not karma, and what is inaction, what is action. They know it. And they always act in perfect harmony as to cause no disturbance in the universal equilibrium. They act in perfect conformity. That's what the sages do, enlightened ones do. And we are in the process of learning it. And it is through this absolutely just and merciful law of karma that we learn and progress and become like those high and wise masters of wisdom. And now, when the person dies, the body is gone, the physician says, okay, he's out, he will give death certificate, and arrangements are made for the funeral. And as far as modern science is concerned, there the matter ends. But science errs there. The real man can never die. Now, the ego stands in the presence of the divine light of its higher self, bathes in that light, and sees, and in minutest detail, every thought and action of his or hers, right from the beginning of its life in the cradle to the last breath on the deathbed. Every event, even to the minutest flash of a thought or a feeling, is reviewed. And in the light of that higher self, which is justice itself, it sees the perfect justice of all it has gone through. Every suffering and tear of pain that it shed, it sees the justice of it. And in fact repents that it ever questioned it. Who said all this? The masters of wisdom have gone through all these states and recorded this. It is there. And it goes into the devakarmic state. How long does devakarmic state last? Centuries. Why centuries? Because that is the power of human thought. We have the stupendous amount of energy, thought energy that is generated. Takes such a long time for it to work itself out. And that is the provision of nature in which the ego enjoys perfect peace, bliss, progress, rest. And then before, when that energy which put it stuck into the state and continues in that state till the energy lost. And when it begins to decline and expire, the ego is drawn back with the karmic bonds of its previous actions. And you know, the ego sees in prospective vision, the light that awaits it, the parentage that it has to take its birth in, and sees the perfect justice of all that is to occur, perfect justice of it, everything, sees in prospective vision, and at the appropriate time, is connected to the body. You know, the astral body is formed in the mother's womb even before the egg is fertilized. The fertilization of the egg and development of the body is only on the mold of the astral, which is formed of its karma. Karma of the ego and karma of the parents and nation, everything is there. Perfect justice of it. So you see here, with absolute justice. Compared to this, you see human justice, how wrong it is. So it's not that we cannot know it, we can know it. But when the ego enters the body and is born, it forgets everything. It is represented in the Greek mythology as the soul is plunged in the river of Lethe. When it is plunged in the river of Lethe, forgetfulness comes over it. It is an allegory. It means this. When it enters the physical life, the ego forgets its past and its true nature. And the ignorant ego, you know, the higher ego remains, is only its efflux, only its shadow, assuming the name and form, does all its actions and experiences the effects of its past actions. Now, this is the mercy of justice of the law of karma. And the mercy of the law of karma is also evident that when we sleep, after the dream state, we go to the deep sleep. No one knows what happens in deep sleep. What happens in deep sleep is, those who know, if you study Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, it's beautifully represented there, that the brain man cannot recollect it, but the ego is free from the bondage of imprisonment of the flesh, and it enjoys its freedom momentarily in its own higher realm, manasic realm, spiritual realm, and partakes of the divine ambrosia, enjoys its bliss. When the man time comes for it to wake, the ego again takes charge of the body. And the man cannot remember those experiences because again we are out of tune with the higher. So, but nevertheless, that bliss of the ego is felt in the deep sleep and it benefits the man. But for that experience, there would have been much more evil in the world. That's why when you awake from a good sleep, we feel very refreshed and energetic because we have touched the divine, merciful aspect of karma. And again, you see the merciful aspect of karma. We see so many people, wicked people, doing such wicked things, and they're enjoying good life with all opportunities, which they misuse to do more evil things. Why? Why did that happen? Merciful aspect of karma. It gives long opportunity for man to make amends and requite himself. It is illustrated in the Mahabharata. In the Shishupala, he is allowed to do 100 mistakes and Krishna remains, does not act. When he crosses the limit, then he acts. So we set up causes and continue to persist in evil. It comes to a tipping point where no one can avert it. It has to react on you. But till then, you get an opportunity of making amends. The merciful aspect of karma. The man who is so well placed and does evil may seem to enjoy it, but then every one of his evil deeds will have to repay for it with corresponding misery and pain. He will not be spared. It's the law of retributive justice take no account of the moral nature, quality of the man, good or bad. Even Ramakrishna, Paramahamsa or Ramana Maharshi had to undergo the pain that of the bodily disease. It is respect of no persons, irrespective of moral quality, acts impersonal, ever active. And then again, you see, our action has produced ill effects. But those who suffer the ill effects are compensated by the law of karma. someone has acted to deprive me of my life, or deprive of my property, or my loved ones, I suffer tremendous pain. Human justice cannot recompense it, but nature's justice recompenses it. In one life or the other, I am recompensed. And whatever loss suffered is fully recompensed with the opportunities and happiness and prosperity. This is the reason why many people who are doing evil are well-placed. Why? Because they have been treated badly with vengeance by their fellow men in the past. So they are doing wrong, enjoying it. So you see here what a mistake we do in vengeance. So when we are hurt by others, it is our duty to forgive. In the light of this higher intuitive spiritual knowledge, and entertain abundance of goodwill, and look for opportunities of returning good for evil, and never retaliate. This is the law of love eternal. And Buddha says, this is Sanatana Dharma. He beat me, he reviled me, he plundered me. Those who entertain such thoughts, they have not freed their minds from hatred and ill will. Those who do not entertain such thoughts have freed their minds from ill will. And hatred can never be conquered by hatred. Hatred can be conquered only by love. This is Sanatana Dharma. This is what the scriptures teach. This is beautifully illustrated in Mahabharata. Is it not? It's beautifully illustrated in Ramayana. So if we read our ancient scriptures in the light of theosophy, great wisdom and knowledge opens up before you. You go beyond the dead letter and see the eternal springs of spiritual wisdom, which is so important for the world. Now, this is historically also, this has been enacted. When South Africa finally was freed itself from apartheid, all the terrible crimes, war crimes committed during the apartheid regime, white against blacks, blacks against whites. So there was going to be a war criminal, there was a talk, there was a choice before the new government headed by Nelson Mandela, whether to set up a war crime and try all those people, bring them to book. And then very wisely the assembly, the government took a decision, that is not the way. So let's not retaliate, let's reconcile in the spirit of forgiveness. So they constituted a commission headed by Desmond Tutu, and then reconciliatory commission, in which was announced all those who committed the offence and the victims, welcome. Those who confessed their offence and asked for forgiveness from the victim, and there is an opportunity for reconciliation and forgetting after forgiving, and no punitive laws will be applied to them. They'll be free. And it was done. And if you read that book, it's very moving. Terrible crimes committed by offenders, they confessed, broke down during the process. The victims break down during the process. And their mutual forgiveness. And then Desmond Tutu writing that book, there is no future without forgiveness. Absolutely true. One of the greatest realities of our age, Desmond Tutu. See, look, in the Second World War, First World War, what did other countries do? They set up war crime courts and tried people who waged war or committed offences, war crimes, and retaliatory justice. And retaliatory justice produces terrible harm to society. It brings about, no one has a right to take away life. Even the state has no right to take away the life of the worst of offenders. Human laws can never punish. Human laws can only be restrictive, reformatory, and educative, and rehabilitative. Like the reformative justice in the African tradition, they call it Ubuntu, which they practiced in South Africa. This is the model for human laws. If the wisdom were to prevail, the whole of our legal system will be reformed in this way. So, now you see other examples of Tibetans. Look, Dalai Lama. Why is he not taking up arms and fighting against the Tibetan cause? He knows this law. He's a wise man. Dalai Lama means ocean of wisdom. He knows. His only law of love eternal alone make for highest progress and reconciliation and perfect justice. And in one of the speeches he said, 1,000 years back, Tibet invaded China and did much harm. He meant by this, what it is suffering now is a karmic retribution for it. So shall we take to arms and complicate the previous injustice done, or shall we reconcile and forgive and build up a harmonious relation through exercise of abundant and unrelenting goodwill? See, and then there's a reason why also Gandhi perfectly understood this, truth and non-violence. People don't understand Gandhi at all. And let's end this talk with a wonderful passage from the Sikh doctrine on this very short passage. If this is realized and non-violence and forgiveness and acceptance of responsibility for the calamities, misfortunes, difficulties we meet in life, if we practice this, 2/3 of the world's misery will disappear of itself. And you make great progress, moral and spiritual growth towards enlightenment and freedom of soul. Now, this is what the Sikh doctrine says. Were no man to hurt his brother, karma nemesis would have neither cause to work for nor weapons to act through. It is the constant presence in our midst of every element of strife and opposition and the division of races, nations, tribes, societies and individuals into Cains and Abels, wolves and lambs, that is the chief cause of the so-called ways of providence. We cut these numerous windings in our destinies daily with our own hands while we imagine that we are pursuing a track on the royal high road of respectability and duty, and then complain of those ways being so intricate and so dark. We stand bewildered before the mystery of our own making and riddles of life that we will not solve. And then finally, if one breaks the laws of harmony, or as a theosophical writer expresses it, the laws of life, one must prepare to fall into chaos one has oneself produced. For according to the same writer, the only conclusion one can come to is that these laws of life are their own avengers, and consequently that every avenging angel is only a typical representative, typified representative, representation of their So let's conclude the meeting here and to take up any questions that you may have.